Welcome to another episode of the Oncology on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Tim Cortese. In this episode, listen to a podcast repurposed from an X-Space hosted by Stephen Liu of Georgetown Lombardi Comprehensive Cancer Center and Georgetown University, and Joshua Sabari of the Perlmutter Cancer Center and the NYU Grossman School of Medicine. Dr. Liu and Dr. Sabari spoke at length about the most profound lung abstracts shared at the 2025 ASCO annual meeting. From CheckMate 816 to Importe to Pacific 15, the conversation covered some of the most promising and practice-changing trials in lung cancer.
So a lot to talk about at ASCO. It's always fun to work through our impressions of these data as they emerge. We're still getting used to sort of some of these new regimens and figuring out how they fit in practice in the real world. Josh, and I think one of the more exciting sessions at ASCO this year was the small cell session. And there were two phase three trials, both published simultaneously in high impact journals that have the potential to change practice. Maybe we'll talk about these two trials. The first one that I wanted to touch on was the Delphi 304 study. Charlie Rudin from Memorial presented these data. This was a randomized phase three study looking at second line tarlatamab versus standard chemotherapy for patients with extensive stage small cell lung cancer, a second line phase three trial that did show a survival benefit. Josh, you know, we've seen the data. How does this change our practice? What do you think of these tarlatamab? All right, Josh is logging on now. But while we're here, I can sort of go over a little bit of background here. Tarlatamab is a bispecific T-cell engager. This is a an engineered molecule that binds to CD3, which is present on our T lymphocytes, and DLL3, which is present on most, about 90% in some reports, of small cell lung cancer cells. Importantly, DLL3 is expressed on other cancer cells as well. A lot of neuroendocrine cells will express it, so maybe some potential role for a drug like this elsewhere, but you're really bringing that T cell together with the T cell, with the tumor cell, and inducing an anti-tumor response. The main toxicities you see with this have to do with that. You see cytokine release syndrome in the majority of patients, tend to be low grade. You see ICANS neurotoxicity, fortunately fairly rare, around 5% or so. The drug works well. We know from the third line setting, response rates around 40%. And what we saw at the time from the earlier Delphi studies was these responses were extremely durable. The durability is something that's sort of unique, but this was an important trial because there's a lot of selection bias in the third line setting. These were done at relatively few sites with a lot of expertise. So there's some people that had a question, would this translate into a larger phase three style? You know, phase three trials are more pragmatic by nature. You have to enroll more patients. And a lot of times we see promising phase one studies become, you know, encouraging phase two and then negative phase threes. So we're kind of holding our breath for this study of tarlatamab versus chemotherapy, but yeah, this was a positive trial, meeting its endpoint. One-to-one randomization of tarlatamab to chemotherapy. It was mostly topotecan, 185 patients with topotecan, 47 lurbinectedin, 23 amrubicin. So this is mostly tarlatamab versus chemotherapy. And I will also say that the control arm topotecan, especially in a platinum-resistant setting, not the best treatment. Topotecan generally doesn't work. And even in the platinum-sensitive setting, we know topotecan is inferior to platinum retreatment. So sort of a low bar, and yet a bar that's been difficult to clear for many other drugs. So what would we see with tarlatamab? And we did see that tarlatamab did improve survival over standard chemotherapy. Median survival, 13.6 months. In the second line setting, it's a phenomenal number. Hazard ratio compared to chemotherapy, 0.6. But this was a clear survival advantage. The PFS data were maybe a little less overwhelming. The PFS data showed a median PFS of 4.2 months versus 3.7. That has a ratio of 0.71 curves that don't really split for about 6 months. And they do seem to widen towards the tail. There's a lot of censoring there. It's really the OS benefit that catches people's eyes. And we see that improvement in OS from 8.3 to 13.6. So tarlatamab was a big story. And there are practical barriers to delivering tarlatamab. I think that today, there are a lot more people that would benefit from tarlatamab than could receive tarlatamab. And it's because, you know, it does require a lot of resources to deliver. It's an expensive drug. It requires inpatient observation for 23 hours on cycle one, day one, day eight, and day 15. And then still pretty long observations of 6 to 8 hours for the second cycle, day one and day 15. Third cycle, it come down to 6 hours by the fourth cycle. After that, you're getting down to about every 2 hour observation. But that's a lot of resources. And I think tying up an infusion chair for 8 hours is a little difficult to do at times. The toxicities are different from chemotherapy toxicities. Cytokine release syndrome is something that we worry about a little bit. And there can be severe cases that require tocilizumab, that require ICU. So there are some infrastructure that needs to be built to deliver this drug. We give this drug pretty frequently now. And while there are, you know, some nuisances from a scheduling standpoint, I think the drug is actually a lot easier to give than it sounds. I think the patients do very well. And while we don't have response rates of 100%, the responses are durable. And the durability is something that's really been fleeting in the setting of small cell lung cancer treatments. So yeah, it's a challenging treatment, but it works. I think there are a lot of unanswered questions. How long do we need to give a drug like this? Is this going to invoke memory, or is this every 2 weeks forever? And I think right now it's open-ended, but these are questions we're looking at. Can we give it purely as outpatient? It's, I think, a big question. It's something that the sponsors are really looking into. The response rate was better than chemo, 35% compared to 20%. There were more durable responses, about 7 months versus 5.5. Really, it's the tail towards that response that's impressive and overall survival. So to me, this is our standard of care, second line. And I do think that we want to let patients get access to tarlatamab whenever possible. We'd love a biomarker to try to understand who is most likely to respond. But this is a clear step up. In the same session, Luis Pazarez from Madrid presented the phase 3 IMforte study. And so this was a small cell trial looking at maintenance lurbinectedin, where all patients with treatment-naive small cell lung cancer received carboplatin, etoposide, and atezolizumab. If patients did not progress, at that point they were randomized to receive standard maintenance lurbinectedin or maintenance lurbinectedin plus, I'm sorry, standard maintenance atezolizumab or maintenance atezolizumab plus lurbinectedin. So adding lurbinectedin to maintenance atezolizumab. Now, when we're adding an active drug, when we're moving something from second line to maintenance, what do we expect before the study opens? You know, we expect that the trial will improve progression-free survival. We expect that we'll see some responses, and we expect that'll come at the cost of toxicity. And we saw all of those things. Adding lurbinectedin in that setting did improve progression-free survival. I think the degree of improvement was more than what some people expected. We saw the PFS hazard ratio 0.54. It's a pretty impressive PFS benefit. Now, one nuanced point here, if you look at the PFS, is that the median of PFS was 2.1 months with atezolizumab. If you look at those numbers and you're familiar with the data, you'll say that seems to have underperformed. But remember, this is measuring PFS from the time of maintenance, not from the time of cycle one, day one induction. So you have to add about 3.5 months to those numbers to really compare absolute results. But the hazard ratio 0.54, and at 6 months, your progression-free survival was 19% with atezo alone, 41% with atezo plus lurbinectedin. So clear improvement in PFS, we expected that. You also see increased toxicity. We also expected that. The rate of grade 3 plus adverse events was 25% with lurbinectedin and atezolizumab. So we are seeing more toxicity. Treatment-related grade 3-4 adverse events, 25.6% with lurbinectedin-atezo, 5.8% with atezo alone. So you're improving PFS at the cost of toxicity. Quick point about toxicity. If you look at adverse events leading to discontinuation or stopping one of the study drugs, that was pretty uncommon, 6.2% versus 3.3%. So we have an improvement in PFS. We have an increase in toxicity. The real question is, does this translate to an improvement in survival? And even though maintenance makes a lot of sense, we've never had a positive maintenance study for survival until this trial. And so, yes, it did lead to an improvement in survival. Curves had split pretty quickly, and an OS hazard ratio of 0.73, which is really what you see, the same degree of survival benefit that you see with IMpower 133 and Caspian, even Adriatic. That's the same hazard ratio for Adriatic. So we're seeing this translate to a survival benefit. And why maintenance is probably a better strategy for our patients than pure second line is because you lose about 50% of patients to attrition. That If you wait until progression, at the time of progression, about half the patients will be too sick to receive therapy, or, you know, sometimes progression itself is fatal. So we see attrition, and even in this study, the attrition rate was about half in both arms. So waiting till second line, you run the risk that patients won't be able to get second line. So now we have a maintenance option that improves survival. Josh, in that small cell setting, what were your thoughts about the Delphi and the IMforte trials?
You know, it's really exciting to see such advances in the small cell lung cancer space. I mean, this has been a drought, you know, for patients, for caregivers, for so many years. I thought the tarlatamab data was quite astonishing. It's truly a novel mechanism of action, as you mentioned, you know, beating out standard of care chemotherapy. But the different lines are becoming very crowded now. You know, as you talked about lurbinectedin in the IMforte in the first line maintenance setting, you know, this is also practice changing. You know, this is a therapy or a space where we've never had any movement for any therapeutics. Remember, we've tried ipilimumab, nivolumab here. We've tried other chemotherapies, and we have not been successful. So this is the first trial. The first maintenance trial in small cell to show any significant PFS and OS. Steve, talking about the IMforte study, what percent of your patients are making it through the first four cycles of carboplatin, etoposide, and a PD-L1 inhibitor?
You know, we like to think that all of our patients do. In the study, you lose about 20 to 25% of patients to attrition. So about 75% of patients made it through induction with a good performance status and, you know, no progression. If you went back to Empower 133, the number's about the same. And so about 25%, because, you know, despite these advances and our enthusiasm, this is a bad disease. This is a lethal disease. And, you know, sometimes patients don't respond. And if they don't, we're in a lot of trouble. So I'd still say, even though I like to think my numbers are higher, the numbers historically would say about 1 in 4 don't really make it to that maintenance session. Is that your sense, Josh?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm seeing in my practice. You know, in my practice, I would say 1 in 4 are not going to make it out past the four cycles. And it's not really due to progression. It's really due to poor performance status, you know, marrow suppression, et cetera. You know, Steve, what about a patient who's admitted to the hospital and gets their first cycle of therapy, carboplatin and etoposide inpatient, and then goes on to get it in the second line? Would that patient be eligible for this regimen, the IMforte regimen?
You know, not you mean just IO in the second line, not IO as part of frontline?
No. I mean, say they get their first line, and a lot of our patients, especially in the community, are getting their chemotherapy while admitted in the hospital. And say they get out and they are able to see us in practice, in the community, let's say, and they go on to get cycle 2 and cycle 3 and cycle 4, would those patients be eligible for lurbi plus atezolizumab maintenance?
Yeah, so obviously those patients are not in the trial. And, you know, if you look at the consort diagram, if they even missed one dose of atezo or chemotherapy, they're not eligible because you need sort of a clean population. But that's what we do as oncologists. You sort of take these idealized data that are very rigid in a very perfect population, and you apply it to the real world where, you know, we don't see these exact situations. Every patient is a little bit different. And so you have to think of the principles here and the spirit of the intervention. In a setting like this, if someone received chemo alone for cycle 1 because they're in the hospital, which you're right, does happen with some regularity, I usually add immunotherapy with cycle 2, 3, and 4. And then if patients are doing well, absolutely, I would offer maintenance lurbinectedin here because we have to extrapolate a little bit. Let me ask you this question, Josh. Let's say you're a person that prescribes durvalumab, which is also FDA approved in this setting with very similar numbers, and the patient's doing well after induction and they've read the social media or the press and they see the survival benefit and they're interested in and they're a good candidate. Would you add lurbinectedin to durvalumab, or would you switch to atezo lurbinectedin, or do you think payers are going to have a role in that?
Yeah, tough question. I think this is something that we're going to start to see in clinical practice for everyone who's using durvalumab in the frontline setting. You know, we are starting to collect data for durvalumab and lurbinectedin, so we'll have an answer to that shortly. But currently, you know, in 2025, I would potentially switch, you know, the PD-L1 inhibitor from durva to atezolizumab to allow patients to benefit from lurbinectedin in the frontline maintenance. But you're right. I'm sure payers are going to give, you know, oncologist patients a very hard time with this. This is a real world issue in our practice.
Yeah, I think that you know, it's good to have these different agents. They are expensive, and so we have to sort of tailor it. We have to find the right patients here. But, you know, survival advantages are hard to come by, and I think we had 2 in one session. So I think a banner day for small cell lung cancer. Josh, let's talk about some of the non-small cell data. I know you do a lot of EGFR work there in New York. Our colleague Jamie Chaff presented NeoAdora. This was neoadjuvant osimertinib, plus chemotherapy versus just chemotherapy, a three-arm randomized study for EGFR mutant lung cancer, resectable EGFR mutant lung cancer. What were your thoughts walking away from the NeoAdora trial?
Yeah, so putting this study into context, you know, in the driver mutation negative population, lots of talk, even at ASCO 2025, about neoadjuvant chemotherapy and immunotherapy. We saw the five-year updated survival from CheckMate 816, right? You know, we're giving a lot of our patients immunotherapy in the early stage setting. We know that EGFR mutant patients do not benefit generally from immunotherapy. So I think this is a really important study, the NeoAdora trial, as you mentioned, looking at osimertinib and chemotherapy in the neoadjuvant setting prior to resection. You know, I'll tell you, as an academic oncologist, I didn't have that much hope because I know that osimertinib does not lead to cure in my metastatic setting. And I was really worried, is this going to translate to the early stage setting? So I've got to tell you, I was pleasantly surprised to see the rates of path CR that we did in the osimertinib single arm, as well as the osimertinib plus chemotherapy. I think what really is going to matter here is the event-free survival and really overall survival. So, you know, is this akin to what we see with immunotherapy leading to durable long-term, you know, responses? What are your thoughts? I mean, what are your thoughts? And is this prime time? Would you do this in practice on Monday morning?
Yeah, probably not. I don't see a problem with it, but I don't know that we'll see a huge advantage. For those that weren't in the room, when you give osimertinib alone, we saw a major pathologic response, meaning there's less than 10% viable tumor, a major pathologic response after 9 weeks of osimertinib alone of about 25%. Now, osimertinib plus chemotherapy was the same, 26%. So one, chemotherapy, not adding a whole lot. If you look at the chemotherapy alone arm, the major pathologic response rate was 2%. So osimertinib is doing the heavy lifting here, and about a quarter of patients will have a major pathologic response. The pathologic complete response in osimertinib alone was 9%, so about 10%. Now, I did think it would be lower, and so I agree with Josh that I was a little, you know, pleasantly surprised by it. But what's the value here? And while we get excited about seeing a path CR with, you know, immunotherapy and chemotherapy, it's because we know over time that path CR translates to long-term survival, even without further therapy, that maybe it increases the likelihood you've cured that patient. We don't know if it means the same thing with targeted therapy, where responses are cheap. Really, you know, we expect responses. It's the durability that we're chasing. So we don't know if it means the same thing. But the real challenge with NeoAdora, you know, it was just a few years too late. By the time this study went up and running, we had already seen the Adora survival data. And so because of that, after completing neoadjuvant therapy, patients could receive whatever adjuvant therapy was appropriate. And for most patients, that meant osimertinib after therapy. In fact, in each arm, 91% of patients who completed surgery went on to receive osimertinib afterwards. And so if you're getting osimertinib for 3 years afterwards, I'm not sure that anything that happened in the 9 weeks before surgery is really going to make a difference in terms of EFS or OS. I think it just all comes out in the wash. So I'd be shocked if we see any difference in EFS or OS as long as patients are able to continue the osimertinib. Right, Josh?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the question of, do you give it before surgery? Do you give it after? This has been the billion-dollar question in the early stage setting for some time, but now we're bringing it into the EGFR mutant population. You know, what's interesting is, you know, what if you have a patient who's stage 3A, maybe borderline resectable, or 3B, you know, all these changes in the AJCC addition now, but say at a borderline resectable case, maybe historically you would have given that patient concurrent chemotherapy and radiation followed by osimertinib, you know, per the LAURA trial. Would you consider using neoadjuvant osimertinib in that patient, especially if we're seeing path CR rates in that 20-25%? You know, and I agree with you. I'd probably do it in combination with chemo, but is there rationale there, or do you think we're just going to see this on the back end in the adjuvant setting?
Yeah, that's a real tough question. Now, that's not what NeoAdora will answer, because NeoAdora was patients
correct,
who were resectable. But that's sort of the application is, you know, if you've got someone that's on the border that's not resectable today, but there's an EGFR mutation, we know that if we give a drug like osimertinib, we're going to see a response. The response rates are very high. And so if we tell our surgeons, give me 9 weeks, I can shrink that down and make it resectable, should we do that? We think we can do that in many cases, but should we do that? Will patients benefit? And we don't have that study. We want that study because that study assumes that surgery is the better local therapy, and surgery provides better long-term outcomes than radiation. And Josh, I feel like I do think that, but I don't have data for that. And it is an assumption. And maybe those patients are better off starting with Laura, or frankly, maybe they're better with Flora 2 or Mariposa. We don't really know the answer. We often have our goal to get to surgery. And I feel like there's always this emotional tie to get to surgery that I fall into myself. But it is making some assumptions, right?
I completely agree. And I'm guilty of doing this off label right now, you know, that borderline resectable case, especially in a young, fit patient. You know, we are hopeful that we can resect. And you're right, there's an emotional attachment to a patient being early stage and having curative intent therapy. We all know that in the metastatic setting, despite our therapies becoming, you know, more and more successful, patients are living longer and doing better. We are unfortunately not curing patients with metastatic disease. So, you know, interesting data, the NeoAdore data. I look forward to seeing the overall survival and how will this be sort of implemented in our practice? It's a really important question.
Yeah, I think it is. Let's talk about some of the data Patrick Ford presented on CheckMate 816. Now, this was the neoadjuvant chemo immunotherapy study. So looking at three cycles of chemotherapy, adding nivolumab to that compared to a placebo. And what we saw in that study, we've known that adding nivolumab improves a pathologic complete response rate up to about 24%. We know that it improves event-free survival. What we didn't know is, did that improve overall survival? And I think some of us were getting a little nervous because we had seen overall survival data for KEYNOTE-671 for the perioperative, giving it pre and post surgery. That did lead to a survival benefit. This was sort of up in the air where we didn't hear it was negative, but we didn't hear it was positive. And then finally we did. This study did meet its survival endpoint. Look at the overall survival, the median OS not reached versus 73.7 months, hazard ratio 0.72, five-year survival rate, 55% with chemo alone, 65% with nivo chemo. We saw a lot of other very interesting data. Patients with PD-L1 positive disease seem to do quite a bit better than PD-L1 negative, where actually the confidence interval was right around one. We saw that those who cleared ctDNA did a lot better. We also saw that those who achieved pathologic complete response had excellent five-year survival rates. In fact, with nivo chemo, those who achieved PathCR, the rate was 95%. So we're seeing really good outcomes for people with PathCR. Josh, how does this change your practice off study?
Yeah, I'm a big user of neoadjuvant or perioperative immunotherapy. And I agree with you. I think we're all getting worried about this neoadjuvant study, right? Nivolumab plus chemo, three cycles followed by resection. You know, a lot of us have moved over to using chemotherapy and immunotherapy with, you know, pembrolizumab-based regimens because it gives us the opportunity for, you know, sort of the adjuvant therapy. I was quite impressed, though, to see the five-year updated overall survival here, particularly as you mentioned, you nailed it on the head, the PD-L1 positive patients. I mean, hazard ratio 0.51. Steve, remember when we were training, I mean, we learned that, you know, patients with stage two, stage three disease had 50, 70% recurrence rates with survival that was on the order of, you know, a few years. We're now hitting in the control arm 6-7 years, and probably because a lot of these patients are going on to immunotherapy when they have recurrent metastatic disease. So I was very impressed by this data. The one thing that I was disappointed by was the PD-L1 negatives, and I think we sort of assume this. Does this change your practice with the PD-L1 negative patients, or are you still attempting to treat them with, you know, neoadjuvant immunotherapy prior to resection?
You know, each case is a little different. I think it does fit into the calculus in some way. And so if there are cases where we're on the border, where we're thinking about, should we go right to surgery? If we wait a little bit, it might require a sleeve resection. Then I kind of factor in, how likely are we to get that PathCR, to get a good response? And if someone comes in and they're PD-L1 negative, maybe a stage two, maybe a never smoker, and the surgeon says, I can take it out now, maybe I do. But certainly PD-L1 positive, my expectations are higher. I'm a believer in the neoadjuvant space, but we have to make these decisions with our patients and our surgeons. And I think seeing that PD-L1 0%, it sort of lowers our pretest probability that we're going to have a robust response. What do you do, Josh?
Yeah, I mean, I would still utilize it in practice. You know, I mean, we see PD-L1 negative patients who do derive benefit in the metastatic setting, and I think we see that also in the early stage setting. But you know, it's hard to sort of predict who that patient is that's going to benefit. And look, we see toxicities with these agents as well. So in a PD-L1 negative patient, you may want to have that discussion. And I just want to, you know, give a big sort of public service announcement here, is that we are talking about driver mutation negative patients in this setting. Remember, if a patient has an EGFR mutation, an ALK fusion, they don't sort of fit into this standard paradigm. So I think this is, you know, here to stay. The neoadjuvant CheckMate 816, you know, also the question of whether to give 671, the pembrolizumab in the perioperative setting, that is one that this study does not answer, but very reassuring, though, to see the five-year OS data. We are truly moving the needle forward in our patients with early stage disease.
Let me touch on one of the abstracts presented by Tina Cascone, the NeoCOAST-2. This is a phase 2 study. We saw initial results there at WCLC in San Diego last year, but this was a multi-arm trial that looked at patients with resectable stage 2 to 3 lung cancer, and they were randomized to receive durvalumab plus chemotherapy with other novel agents, such as oleclumab, which is a CD73 inhibitor, monalizumab, an NKG2A inhibitor, or datopotamab, a TROP2 antibody drug conjugate, and then continued with durvalumab afterwards. If you look at the first two arms, the oleclumab arm, you continued oleclumab afterwards. If you look at monalizumab, you continue monalizumab. Datopotamab, you actually only gave the neoadjuvant, and then after surgery, just went on durva alone. And really what we saw there was a different pathologic complete response rates. And I think of note, if we look at the path CR rates in arm one, for example, 20% with oleclumab at CD73, 26% with monalizumab, the NKG2A, but with durvalumab, 35%. So higher path CR rates with durvalumab. The major pathologic response rate was 63% with datopotamab. You know, when we look at the neoadjuvant space, we believe that path CR really leads to better long-term outcomes. And so now there are a lot of efforts looking to push path CR up with novel agents. Josh, is this maybe where datopotamab ends up making its biggest impact?
You know, it's interesting. I'm not a huge fan of dato, just given the tox profile. I think it's a tough therapy to administer, particularly in the neoadjuvant setting. But, you know, maybe this is where the drug sort of pans out in this population. You know, first off, you know, congratulations to Tina Cascone and the investigators for taking a space that is complex, you know, pretty saturated right now, but it's a platform for us to study novel combinations in the early stage setting. So I love the design of this trial. I love that we're bringing therapies from the metastatic setting earlier on. You know, my only concern, you know, if these arms are positive, and some of the data you mentioned sounds extremely exciting in this setting, we're increasing potentially the path CR rate. How do we run these randomized trials with so much data and so many now approved regimens? So, I mean, let's say the dato arm is positive, right, on the NeoCOAST trial. Steve, how would you sort of think about, you know, moving forward with a phase 3 study in this setting? What would your control arm be?
I think that, you know, you've got to look at the approved regimens as your controls, and it's a little tricky. You got to get buy-in from the FDA that we can use PathCR as a surrogate endpoint to OS. And I think that it does make sense to do that. What I'm hoping, what I envision the future being is, you know, we want to push PathCR, and we can do that by adding more drugs. It is going to add more tox and more cost. And so we want to do it when we need to do it. So I think what makes the most sense, and I know we're going to have studies with this design, is we start off with neoadjuvant chemoimmunotherapy. And then one very good predictor of not achieving a path CR is not clearing your ctDNA. And so if patients do not clear ctDNA, basically they will not achieve a path CR. And so in those patients, does escalating care make a difference? In those patients, does giving something novel to push the path CR rate translate to a better EFS and a better OS? I think that's how we enrich our population and really try to deliver these more aggressive and more toxic and more costly combos just where they're needed and not really in an empiric way. But we need studies. And, you know, speaking of needing more studies, our friend Ben Levy presented TROPION-Lung02. This was a frontline study looking at datopotamab plus pembrolizumab or datopotamab plus pembrolizumab plus platinum in the frontline setting. And so this was looking at frontline doublet or triplet combinations. We did not see randomization to standard of care. This is really gathering safety signals and efficacy. Josh, is this the wave of the future? Is this what we're going to see? ADCs replacing platinum partners?
I mean, we already have, you know, phase three studies ongoing in this space, TROPION-Lung07, Lung08. We also have the AVENZAR trial ongoing. You know, I think this is important data for us to see, single arm phase two data for us to understand the safety profile, you know, particularly Dato-DXd plus pembrolizumab. You know, we were all concerned about rates of interstitial lung disease, pneumonitis, and also to see the rates of toxicity in combination, you know, three drug combinations, including chemotherapy. Look, these trials are ongoing. I think the biggest issue here, Steve.
Hello? Did you guys lose Josh too? Maybe I'll ask our host.
Yeah, I think I just lost him as well.
He just was building in a natural cliffhanger by asking the biggest issue. He's a little bit of a drama queen over there. But what I can say is, you know, we're adding toxicity when we add these drugs. And, you know, it's a real concern. It's difficult to interpret some of these studies, though. They're very selective and they're small. And in this study, there's a lot of heterogeneity. For example, patients didn't all receive the same doses. There was imbalance in patients with brain metastases. When you look at the doublet and triplet, the doublet actually seemed to perform quite a bit better than the triplets. Not what we would have expected. We give more drugs, we expect greater efficacy. That is not what we saw. We saw the doublet had a better response rate of 55%. Well, that was pretty similar. But the PFS actually was 11.2 months with a doublet and only 6.8 months with a triplet. Probably related to imbalances, but we'll see really if the ADCs are better partners. And there's reasons that they might be. You might see more immunogenic cell death with the ADCs. You might see a better disruption of the architecture that allow T cells to access these agents. But there are certainly some that wonder if ADCs are just more expensive chemotherapy, but not more effective. We'll have to see. Josh, you left us with a cliffhanger. You said the biggest issue with these ADCs is what?
Toxicity.
Yeah.
And also the lack of a biomarker and who to select, you know, that additional toxicity. So for me in clinic, if I have a selection factor like positive ctDNA or some biomarker that is going to enrich for response to these medicines that have more toxicity, you know, are these chemotherapy on a stick or are these guided missile type chemotherapy? And I think that's really the biggest question in the room.
Josh, since he's not here, what did you think of Ben's explanation of the QCS NMR biomarker? This is trying to measure the uptake internalization. Knowing that expression of TROP2 has not been a great predictor for TROP2 ADCs, but we also know that ADCs, at least this ADC with this linker, needs to be internalized in order to be activated. And so maybe a measure of how much of the receptors is, you know, becoming internalized and receptor trafficking might be a better biomarker for this particular ADCs. What do you think of the ADC biomarker that he described? We saw it from Arena in the fall and the data they showed of that.
Yeah, first off, I think a lot of hand waving regarding sort of internalization and trafficking of the receptor. I mean, that's been the theory behind, you know, trastuzumab, deruxtecan efficacy in the HER2 exon 20 population. And maybe there's some rationale there as to why driver mutant patients are responding and having more durable responses to some of these ADCs. You know, the QCS score that AstraZeneca is moving forward, kudos to them for doing this and looking at it. And again, you need digital pathology, you need to image the slide, and they retrofit a model to understand who are patients that respond and who are patients that don't respond. And they then use that model to then, you know, prospectively look at biomarker selection for patients. So I'm not sure we understand why or what factors are there. And maybe we don't need to understand that. But, you know, this is something that we are mostly starting to do in academic settings. Are you guys digitally pathology now, or are you still doing it manual, old age type pathology?
Yeah, we're still a little old school there. I mean, I think there you need some infrastructure, you need the materials, but you also need ways to sort of store and transmit that information in a compliant way. And transmission of that to an AI black box, you know, there are some that take a pause before that big step, you know, and some wondered, how will the FDA look at this? Basically, black box, can you picture, I'm going to transmit a slide to you, and then you tell me if your drug is going to be effective. And the answer is like, yeah, it's effective. Just trust me. I know you can't.
Works in everyone.
So there's
an interesting, interesting question.
Little leap of faith.
Little leap of faith.
Interesting one here, Josh. We saw that Yongcheng Zhang from China presented a randomized study looking at time of day of immunochemotherapy. And basically in a prospective way, people randomized to receive immunotherapy plus chemotherapy in the morning or in the afternoon. And there was a pretty big difference in survival favoring the morning. We look at PFS, the hazard ratio was 0.42. We look at overall survival, the hazard ratio for OS was 0.45 by giving the drug in the morning. Josh, can you explain this and do you believe it? And are you changing your practice?
Yeah, this is one of those sleeper abstracts that, you know, really no one really was sort of talking about pre-ASCO and then post-ASCO. I think this got a lot of attention, you know, more so from the bean counters at our institutions, right? Are we going to have to move chairs around and restaff scheduling and all that? You know, I think there's probably a lot of bias here, right? You know, people that are up in the morning and able to be in the cancer center at 7 a.m., maybe they have more going on and they're just more active and fit versus a patient who can get to the cancer center or their clinic at 12 o'clock or 1 o'clock. So, you know, I'm not sure. I mean, there's a lot of talk about circadian rhythm and you know, sort of immune activation, you know, during different times of day and whether you ate or didn't eat. So I think there's a lot of hand waving here. I thought the abstract was quite interesting. I think we need more data to better understand this interesting phenomenon. Steve, do you think this is sort of hullabaloo or do you think this is real? I don't know what that word is though.
Yeah, I don't know if you said it right either. I think that
I don't think I did.
I don't understand it completely. And I've asked a lot of my immunology colleagues, melanoma colleagues, and certainly we know there's a lot that influences our immune response that we don't completely understand. We know there's huge impacts from, you know, diet, microbiome, and you know, could time of day influence things? There's been a wealth of data showing similar results. But the problem with most of the existing data is retrospective. And when you have retrospective data, there are all these factors, like you mentioned, that could explain the results that people that get treated in the morning, maybe they're the ones that are having, you know, that have a higher socioeconomic status that can take time off of work, that, you know, have greater support networks. Maybe those are the ones that are seeing the more established oncologists that get the morning slots that are a little more desirable. And so there are potential confounders. This was randomized. And in this study, there wasn't a lot of informative censoring. And so patients, you know, sort of stayed on the protocol. We'll wait for the publication, which will be important. But this was a prospective randomized study. So a lot of that should have come out in the wash. And to see that much effect size, there's something here. There might be confounders, yes. But, you know, if it doesn't cost us anything to give treatment in the morning, why not do that? I think that use of sub-Q is going to make that a little bit easier too. So yeah, I'm shifting most of mine to the morning and, until you tell me otherwise. I don't see a downside to doing that. But I would like to understand it better.
Yeah, completely agree. And you know, some of my patients like to sleep in, you know, or they're older and, you know, they have other things going on. And, you know, I think it's interesting. It might change how we think about practice. You know, we always think that the drugs we use with targeted therapies, with chemotherapies, work the same as they do every time of day, any time of day. Here, this is really one of those first abstracts that makes you think about, you know, sort of, is there more than we understand with these agents? And could explain a lot of the sort of, you know, wish-washy results we've received in other trials. I'll tell you, most of my clinical trial patients, particularly in early phase development, are going to be here at the cancer center at 7 a.m., right? I know that's not what happens in community practice all around. So it'll be interesting to see this publication. I'm sure we'll scrutinize it in a lot of detail.
Josh, I want to get your, we're going to wind down here, but I did want to get your take on the presentation that Tony Mock presented. And I think a year ago, we were sold this was going to change practice, standard of care, that this was a big one to watch, but maybe a bit of a disappointment. Tony presented the Herthena Lung 2 study. This looked at patritumab deruxtecan, the HER3-DXd, an antibody drug conjugate targeting HER3, delivering a topo 1 payload. This was in OC-resistant EGFR mutant lung cancer, and basically randomized patients to receive second-line HER3-DXd or platinum double chemotherapy, platinum pemetrexed, primary endpoint PFS. Now, when you look at the study, we saw that the trial did lead to a PFS benefit, that the PFS hazard ratio was 0.77, little underwhelming maybe. The median PFS, 5.4 months to 5.8 months. Hazard ratio of 0.77, p-value of 0.011. Curves that do separate after about 4 months, but modest improvement in PFS, no difference in OS. The survival that we saw here. These curves really just overlap. If we look at the median OS, 16 months with HER3-DXd, 15.9 with chemo. The OS hazard ratio, 0.98. There was some difference in intracranial progression. There was a difference in response rate, 35% versus 25%. There was a difference in toxicity. Although, frankly, the numbers wise, if you look at discontinuations, if you look at dose reductions, if you look at grade 3 adverse events overall, all those numbers were higher with HER3-DXd. So, Josh, walking out of Tony's presentation, what are your thoughts on patritumab, and does this drug have a future?
Yeah, this was a disappointing one. You know, as you said, you know, take us back 1 year, June 2024. I mean, we were waiting for an approval, at least in the U.S., an accelerated approval for this agent. You know, they had that CRL due to manufacturing issues. And as you mentioned, very strong PFS. But unfortunately, you know, overall survival is king, and they did not hit on overall survival. You did mention, you know, a slight nuance that in patients with brain metastases, it did seem that there was a slight benefit in, sort of intracranial response and durability of response, but we're talking about less than a month in this patient population. So I'm not sure there's a real space for this agent, particularly given the toxicities. Remember, ADCs are chemotherapies, right? I mean, these are chemotherapeutics, the deruxtecan, TOPO1 payload, significant grade 3 toxicities in my mind, mostly hematologic. But yeah, this one hurts because I thought this would become the standard of care in the third line setting in EGFR mutant lung cancer. And I don't think there's a true future ahead for this agent.
Josh, before we close here, you had a poster. I didn't get to see it because the problem with the poster session is when you're at your poster, you don't get to see other people's posters. But you had some data on Beamian Lung 1, right? Can you sort of summarize what you showed there?
Yeah, so Beamian Lung 1 is a study of a drug called, I'm losing my mind here, zongertinib, formerly known as BI-181. And it's a very interesting HER2-specific tyrosine kinase inhibitor. So it doesn't inhibit EGFR. And John Hamak presented at ACR 2025 just a few months ago and published in New England Journal of Medicine, impressive response rates north of 80%. Progression-free survival about 12.4 months. So really durable activity with this agent. Again, these are patients specifically with HER2 exon 20. One nice thing about this drug is very little skin toxicity, if any, very little GI toxicity, and essentially no pneumonitis. So we presented a poster of the patient-reported outcomes evaluating physical function and symptom management, and really across all of these sort of validated scales or tools. We saw that patients had improvement in their functional status, their respiratory status, and these occurred really early on, one and a half months in, sort of similar to where we saw the responses radiographically by RECIST. So it's an exciting drug. There's a PDUFA date for zongertinib coming up this August. So hopefully I can shake up the second line setting for HER2 exon 20 insertion mutant non-small cell lung cancer. But you had a poster as well. You want to close out, Steve, on your poster? Looking at OSC2101 versus docetaxel?
Yeah, OSC2101 is Tadopi, and this is a therapeutic cancer vaccine. This is a drug that Benjamin Bess had presented on from the Atalante trial. This is the Atalante study showed that when we compared OSC2101, when we compared Tadopi to standard chemotherapy in the third line setting, and it led to a survival benefit at the OS 11.1 versus 7.5 with a hazard ratio of 0.57. And that was specifically in people that had secondary resistance to immunotherapy, not primary resistance, secondary resistance. But the study was a little bit underpowered for that. It stopped early because of COVID. Here, this phase 3 trial, the Artemia study, is really randomizing in the second line setting to Tadopi, the OSC2101 vaccine, off-the-shelf vaccine, versus docetaxel in patients with secondary resistance to immunotherapy. I'm the PI for this study along with Benjamin Bess. Enrollment ongoing now. This is, a very important therapeutic vaccine with pretty minimal toxicity compared to docetaxel. Primary endpoint here is a hard overall survival endpoint. So study enrolling, ongoing, hoping to have some results for us in the relatively near future and really trying to unseat docetaxel. Of note though, this is restricted to the HLA-A2 subtype. So hopefully have a little more data there. I think a fruitful ASCO. We're going to digest this information. And then, Josh, as soon as we got it all figured out, it'll be time for WCLC, right?
Yep, I'm excited.
All right, everybody. Well, thanks so much for joining us on this space. Hope to see you soon in the next one. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology on the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or you can listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology on the Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at cancernetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at cancernetwork.